Matthew 24, we just finished the book of Daniel. With that on Wednesday night as a background and our time together this morning, Jesus is going to be very prophetic. Before we dive into chapter 24, let's not forget what happened in chapter 23. This is a couple days after the triumphal entry of our Lord, the palm branches, and they were singing the Hallel, the Psalm 118 and following. He stops the whole parade. He begins to weep over Jerusalem. Oh, Jerusalem, if only you would have known what this day was. It's fulfilling the book of Exodus chapter 12, that on the 10th of Nisan, you select your Passover lamb, because on the 14th of Nisan, the Passover, is when that lamb, his blood is shed. Jesus came into Jerusalem on a Sunday. It was Nisan the 10th, the same day Jesus was on the Mount of Olives, presenting himself on the donkey, powerful visual cue of Zechariah 9, verse 9. He's sending there 173,880 days to the day that Daniel chapter 9 said he would be there. He's standing where? On the Mount of Olives. Ezekiel, when he was taken to Babylon all those years in front, he saw in the Spirit the glory of the Lord depart Jerusalem. From what geographic location? The Mount of Olives. The glory of the Lord had returned on the donkey, on the 10th of Nisan, just like Daniel had said, on the Mount of Olives. And as a rule, what did the people do? They're like, okay, Jesus, go start kicking out Romans and let's begin this millennial reign. And as typical, Jesus didn't do anything that the humans sort of expected of him. He cleansed his father's house. And then as a nation, they said, well, you're not our Messiah. And then for the next couple of days, he was staying probably at Mary and Martha's house. And then he would go back and forth each day and teach. He said, you scribes and Pharisees, you asked me, by what authority are you doing these things? Chapter 21 and 2 was all about answering that. And then in chapter 23, then he had something to say to the religious leaders of his day. If anybody should have seen what day this is, it was you guys. Because you want to puff out your chest and be respected and make a little coin, you muddy the waters of the very clear and simple path to salvation. One of the last things he said last chapter was, and Jerusalem is going to be laid waste. And then he sort of said, I'm done talking with you guys. And then out of Mount Zion he goes, across the Kidron Valley, and he's ascending again the Mount of Olives. And this is where the story takes place for the next two chapters. It's called the Olivet Discourse for you Bible students. Then Jesus went out and departed, verse 1, from the temple, and his disciples, they came up to show him the buildings of the temple. What's ringing in their ear? It's all going to burn. It's all going down. And they're thinking, well, wait a minute. Aren't you the Messiah? They had that correct. And aren't we supposed to be ruling and reigning here any minute in the millennial reign? Yes, that will happen one day, but not this day, as you know. They still weren't getting the whole crucifixion portion. God's innocent blood shed for us guilty. If there's no Jerusalem, well then, what nation will we have to sort of be drivers for? The disciples knew Jesus pronounced Jerusalem's destruction, but like most of us humans, they still love their buildings. They still love their process. They still love their heritage structures and programs. Hey, Lord. I'm sorry about those scribes and Pharisees. We all know that they're out to lunch. But stop for a second. Yes, guys, turn around. Look at the buildings. Which is to say, look at all the activity of people giving their sacrifices and all. Look at everybody greeting each other. Look at all the small group little studies that met in Solomon's colonnade area. Look at the bustle. Look at the smiles on people's faces. It's a little bit like, you know, da 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 da. A little bit like Christmas. Isn't that kind of cool? The temple was the very symbol of the nation. Remember, they're thinking that millennial reign is going to start here any minute. So we're going to keep the temple, right? Listen to what they're really saying. Jesus, we're pretty sure that when you really get things rocking, it's probably going to look like, oh, and then they get to insert their little video vignette that's playing in their brain. I don't know, do they see each other sort of presiding over the thousands and thousands and thousands thronging to this beautiful structure? Do they see themselves sort of indispensable with these intense discipleship programs? Do they sort of imagine them sitting like rabbis would do and the huge crowds standing, hanging on their every word? And after all, you got to have a facility for that. I don't know that that is what they're thinking, but I know that that's high on the human's priority list. What do you mean? What's a successful ministry? What does it look like? Would you even recognize that you're driving by one? In other words, humans have this idea of what success looks like. If you will, success is really cool buildings, lots of people, and intense programs of connections where the humans can come in and be ministered to by the other humans. I don't see that as the model in Scripture for Jesus. He here in a minute is going to blow up. He's going to blow up his second megachurch. What? Jesus had a megachurch? Or didn't you hear? A couple of years in front of that, when he was getting started, he was in the Galilee. And the shores were teeming with people all around at that time. And he numbered 5,000 men, and then the Bible says, plus their families. So what would that be? How big's that crowd? Call it 15,000? We better get him something to eat. And he says to Andrew, he says, hey, Andrew, go get him something to eat. Andrew probably looked at his credit card and went, I don't think I have enough room on this for all of these people. There's no Walmart open at this hour. So he goes through the crowd and he finds a kid who has a lunch with a couple of fishes and some loaves of bread. He had a sparkle of faith. But then he says, but what is this among so many? We don't have much, Lord. Lord goes, I know. That's how it often is when I'm ministering. And then Jesus perhaps smiles, but it's all I need. You know the story. 5,000 men plus their family were fed. Then the boys get in the lake and they go across to the other side. And much of that crowd stampedes around and meets the group there the next day. And they're shouting, good to see you, Jesus. Look at us, we're practically all here. Do another miracle. What were they really saying? Give us some more stuff to eat. That bread was astounding. I'm pretty sure it was gluten-free and it was really delicious. And the sushi, can we talk about the flavor of that? And so the very next day, perhaps 15,000 people were all in the pews, ready to receive. To receive what? What I want. You got any of that? Jesus had a megachurch. He had the first multi-thousand congregation all listening to him. And all the disciples were going, this is kind of cool. Look at all the people. And you remember what Jesus did with his first mega church attendance? He said to them, he basically is saying, I know why you're here, guys. And on the outside, it looks pretty fabulous, but I know the hearts. You all are not here for me. You are here for what I can give you. And then he says, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you can have no part with me. So the crowd, imagine the camera swinging around the other one. We're here for you, Lord. And then when they heard that, they're all. Did he? What? You could hear them one by one drop their excited hands to their sides and move away in a greatly disappointed fashion. I wonder what the disciples were thinking. Lord, you have 15,000 in your church. Why did you say that? Then Jesus turns to the 12 and he goes, so you guys going to leave too? Now we know that Jesus was speaking of communion, that he would take the Seder dinner of the Passover, he would take the middle matzah, what the Jews call the aufikomen, that was snapped in half. One half was hidden in a shroud. And as kids, they probably fondly remembered, because when you snapped it in half and hid one half in the shroud, then that was part of the fun. The kids would go running through the place trying to find it, because whoever finds the aufikomen gets a treat. But they're big teenagers now. But I wonder if they smiled, aufikomen, oh yeah. A year later, Jesus snaps that matzah, perhaps, or a bread similar. He snaps it in half, and then he says, this is my body broken for you. There are four cups in the Passover dinner. He takes the third cup, and he says, this is my blood spilled for you. That's a year away, perhaps a year and a half away. So Peter, James, John, and all, you're going to leave too? That cannibal comment was really something. What you said, I'm having a hard time with. But I know who you are. And I know enough of your character. You're probably not talking about me eating John or his skinny brother James. That was Jesus' first megachurch, you guys. Imagine that. Opening door, first church service at Harvest, 350 South Rock Boulevard. Come on down. And our very first Sunday, we have 15,000 people. And Pastor Steve gets up and says, something strange. And everybody leaves but 12. And you come across the 12 the next Sunday. Plenty of parking. A lot of slips are open. Plenty of places to sit. And if you happen by that church, would you describe it as successful? Before we cluck our tongue at these disciples, seriously, you guys are all hung up about the building, you know? It's about Jesus. We have it within us to do the same. What is a successful ministry, Harvest? Interesting idea. Were they thinking, well, yeah, when we get a hold of the temple, though, and the thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands are thronging to this awesome structure, we'll do it right. Not like those crazy Pharisees and Sadducees. That's because when revival breaks out, it looks like. And that's what they thought. Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. You couldn't possibly be talking about this beautiful temple. Jesus says, it's not that at all. Would we be willing to have him take our little temples and say, look at verse 2. And Jesus said to them, you think these buildings are cool? I got something for you. Do you not see all these things, which is the temple, the people, and the programs of what many of the Jews would describe as a wonderfully successful process? Jesus has just dismantled that notion by dressing down the leaders. Do you see all these things? Structures, rituals, and programs. Do you see all of these things? Most assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down. When revival comes rolling through my life or my family, it's going to look like this. What if Jesus says it's not going to look anything like that? Will we be like those 15,000 when they didn't hear what they were hoping for, who dropped their chin in disappointment and disapproval and voted their allegiance with their feet and left? In 38 years from now, five Roman legions consisting of 6,000 men per legion descended into this area, and they laid siege to Jerusalem. The troops are given strict orders, do not destroy the temple, because it was a magnificent structure. As the history books tell us, somebody lobbed a flaming arrow in through the open door of the temple, and some of the fabric on the inside caught fire. And such a huge inferno ensued, the marble facing and the precious gold melted and popped. And the gold was so thoroughly liquefied that it ran down the smallest cracks and crannies of the rocks and the walls around. And when the smoke was cleared and the fires had cooled, the Roman soldiers, 30,000 of them with nothing else to do, heard about the gold that was wedged between the stones. So what did they do? They systematically dismantled every single stone. And by the time they were done, Jesus' fulfilled prophecy is still hanging crisply in the air. Verse 3. By the way, my goal is to get down to around verse 13. So if you're looking at your watch, you're going to make it. It's going to be okay. Verse 3. Now he sat on the Mount of Olives. The disciples came to him privately, saying, what were you talking about? Tell us, when will these things be? That's question number one. When's the temple going to get destroyed? What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? The Olivet Discourse is pretty simple. It's a three-point message. The first are verses 1 through 14. Jesus is going to talk about the end times at large, the people in general, and it's going to have a simultaneous prophecy regarding the 70th week of Daniel, or the Great Tribulation. Much of Old Testament Bible prophecy and New Testament Bible prophecy has a near fulfillment. It's almost like a dress rehearsal, a model, because when the far fulfillment comes true, it's going to come true exactly as the model predicted. We're going to have a description in verses 1 through 14, the end times from when Jesus spoke these words till today, and the six seals opened in the book of Revelation, chapter 6, are going to be outlined here in just a minute. Verses 37 through 42, Jesus is going to focus in on the church specifically and the rapture. So, when will the temple be destroyed? Matthew does not record Jesus' direct answer, but Luke does. In the same section, Luke 21, verse 20 says, "And when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, five Roman legions in the year 70 AD, then know that desolation is near." Number two, what will be the sign of your coming? That'll be point number two we'll look at next week. That's the completion of the book of Revelation, in a sense, or the 70th week of Daniel. And then number three, what will be the end of the age? The age of the law. The age of the prophets and the judges. And now this current age, what age would they be referring to? In 606 BC, Nebuchadnezzar, king of the Babylonian Empire, he rolled through and destroyed Jerusalem. And from that day on until this day right here, the Jews had a sort of a land to call their own, to call Israel. But were they the sovereign rulers of that era? Mm-mm. Ezekiel chapter 30, verse 3, for you note takers, that's what Jesus referred to as the time of the Gentiles. How much longer will the Gentiles rule the roost in this region? That's what they were saying. Let's watch Jesus' response. Verse 4. And Jesus answered and said to them, "Take heed that no one deceives you." Can I rephrase that? Hey, harvest, get this right. Paul says in three different locations, church, I do not want you to be ignorant about three things. Don't be ignorant about spiritual gifts and how they are used. Don't be ignorant about spiritual warfare and how to address the demonic forces that are battling against us. And then number three, don't be ignorant about the rapture and end times Bible stuff. Let me ask you, what is the church most goofed up on? Spiritual gifts, spiritual warfare, and end times Bible prophecy. That's one of the reasons, Harvest, we go through the book like we do, verse by verse. We've been in Daniel on Wednesday, and here we are in Matthew, and watch it all dovetail together. Take heed, Harvest, let no one deceive you. This is how the Gentile nations will see this end of the age. I'll give you a little bit of a hint. It's going to be like birth pains. Some of you moms know exactly what I'm talking about. The baby's coming. We're anticipating for the entire duration of gestation. And then when the time is very, very near, you have birth pains. And then, ooh, that wasn't so bad. And then, what is it, 15 minutes apart, ooh, then you have another one. Birth pains start relatively, I know, ladies, don't throw anything at me. You know, guys are all, come on, honey, you can do this, you know. I read one account, husband leans into wife and she's in the middle of a contraction. How bad is it, honey? She says, take your lower lip and wrap it around the back of you. That might be close. They start relatively severe, and then what happens? They grow in intensity, and they come closer and closer to each other. Until finally in transition, as some of you know, they're one right on top of the other in the most severe of the entire process. It's a very challenging time physiologically, emotionally. It's really tough on our wives and our beautiful brides. But what always happens soon after that very intense period of time, something beautiful is birthed. It's not used by happenstance, this birth pains. We're going to see here that the next several descriptions, they're going to start as the world will observe them, as the Gentile nations see them coming, kind of mild, relatively so, and relatively far apart. But toward the end, they will be much more significant